this is my club. I fucking love this football club. And I look at you lot, this is a great team. This is a great team. I've been a fan all my life. This is what we have to do. We have to go out and win. Win every tackle. When you score, you can look in their faces. Look at the emotion. Look how much they love you. And show them how much you love them. Okay?
Guys, we are so privileged to be here.
When you hear the air attack warning, you and your family must take cover.
Welcome to It's an Arsenal Thing. I'm your host, Tom, and with me is a man who is the antidote to common sense. He's a fashion anomaly and someone who calls socks foot gloves. It can only be Silent Dave Hutchinson. All right, my man, a fleeting thumbs up and a nod, that'll do. Does anything you're wearing make sense on any level? You're just missing a sombrero and it looks like you've raided a child's fancy dress box. On the menu tonight, and what a menu it is, Dave, we have the Arsenal midfield legend, known as Paul Davis, whose book, Arsenal and After, has just been released. He joins myself and Paul in the gum room to reflect on his career past and present. So looking forward to that. Let's just remind you of the honours. Football League First Division, 88-89 season and 90-91. FA Cup, 92-93. Football League Cup, 86-87 and 92-93. Football League Centenary Trophy in 1988. European Cup Winners Cup, 93-94. And last but not least, the FA Charity Shield in 1991. Lauren takes us through the North London Derby in the WSL with not a stone unturned, I can promise you that. And myself, Jay, Lauren and Nick from the Arsenal Brothers podcast look back at the heroes and the villains, past encounters and favourite matches and moments. Connor delivers a player profile on Abu Diaby and what might have been. Let's remind ourselves that he was once described as the next Patrick Vieira. He had the height, the poise, the balance, the skill, the physique, but sadly, so many injuries, we never really got to see him at his best.
It's an Arsenal thing, it's an Arsenal thing. Believe it or not, it's an Arsenal thing. With football and transfers, you know you'll bring. You're listening to It's an Arsenal Thing.
Next, it's the North London Derby with Lauren in Gonna Get Into It.
Hello and welcome to this week's Arsenal Women's Update. I'll be speaking about our record-breaking match against Spurs in the Emirates Stadium. I'll have a quick look at how the WSL is getting on so far, and I'll be looking at our chances of qualifying for the Champions League. Do we still have hope? Let's get into it, shall we? So even if we were Premier League-less this weekend, we did have the WSL to look forward to, and boy, did we have a big one to look forward to. Credit to the FA, they really are organising the WSL this season in the most optimal way possible. So we had a few crunch matches this weekend, a few massive derbies. We had, for example, Merseyside Derby, which took place in Anfield, Everton against newly promoted Liverpool, who managed to secure a shock win in their first match of the season. And of course, we had the big one, Arsenal versus Spurs in the North London Derby, held at the Emirates. How did we get on? So it was the first match of match day two, and after the opening weekend fixtures, Arsenal were top of the league, joined with United. Both teams secured a 4-0 victory over their opponents on opening day. The big surprises, of course, from the first few matches were City's loss to Villa, losing 3-4 at home. prior to this match, Villa had never scored against City, so it definitely came as a surprise. We've mentioned this before, City have had a massive reshuffle in their team, so obviously it's going to take a bit of time for them to gel, to get used to it. But that was a shocker, a big shocker, 3-4 to Villa. And of course, we had Liverpool beating Chelsea. The newly promoted side managed to secure 3 points against last season's winners. All 3 goals in that game came from the penalty spot, but Arsenal were on top going into their most challenging fixture so far versus Spurs. Despite their stellar start to the season, Arsenal did suffer a bit of a midweek blip, shall we say, a bit of a hiccup in their Champions League first leg playoff versus Ajax. That game ended 2-2, leaving their hopes for a Champions League spot in the balance. Second leg gets underway on Wednesday, so fingers crossed that we perform better and we can secure European football. But going back to this weekend, how did Arsenal get on? Did their Champions League upset affect their stellar league run? Starting 11, Zinsberger in goal. We had back four of Weinreuter, Williamson, Rafaela, centre-back pairing, and Kately came in at left-back, pushing Katie McCabe up to a slightly more attacking position on the left. Little and Valti joined her in midfield. Viviana Miedema was our striker of the day, with Ford playing on the right and Mead on the left. Kickoff got underway at 1:30 local time, and the BBC did a fantastic job of building up the match. Football Focus, I think, was on at 12, and they spoke about it all the way through. I think there was a little break for something random like Antique Roto or something for half an hour. that didn't dampen anyone's excitement for the match of the day. No pun intended, with BBC, haha. Players were tweeting about the match all week. There was a real sense of excitement around it. And I think, in credit to the BBC, they did an exceptional job of capturing that. So the game got underway and Arsenal looked comfortable from the go. In the 3rd minute, Valti lost the ball on the edge of the box, only to win it back, picking out Meath, whose strike on goal was deflected behind for a corner. It wasn't long after that, though, that Arsenal found the back of the net. The chance was created by captain Kim Little in midfield, who did very well to retain possession from a very tight situation. Her pass absolutely sliced the Spurs defence open, finding Meath just inside the box. Although her first attempt, which appeared to be more of a pass, was blocked, the ball landed back at her feet and she did what Betmead does, putting the ball into the back of the net. 1-0 to the Arsenal. From there, Arsenal really were relentless. It was a midfield masterclass. Spurs couldn't break them down, and McCabe and Ford were two names worth mentioning. They had a superb performance yet again. One thing that I did notice were Arsenal's creative set pieces, often taken short, catching their unsuspecting defence off guard. 38th minute, they had their first shot on target, which was taken very comfortably by Zinsberger. They created some really good chances, Arsenal. Little hit the side netting, Ford headed just wide from a lethal cross from McCabe, but nothing was really going our way. Similar situation to our previous two matches so far this season. It just seems like we're missing that very clinical touch in crucial moments. That being said, Arsenal were granted a little bit of luck thanks to a pretty poor piece of play from the Spurs keeper to her centre-back in the 44th minute. A poor touch, which Ford was able to capitalise on, creating a lovely chance for Miedema to slot the goal past the goalkeeper, as cool and composed as you like. Her first of the season. I think had it have been 1-0 going into half-time, Spurs would have had a slightly better chance of pulling things back. They created absolutely no chances during the first half. They couldn't break us down. So, them getting 2 goals was almost unthinkable. Apart from our second goal, they defended very, very well, it has to be said. One name worth mentioning is Ashley Neville. I know a lot of Arsenal fans don't like her, but she did defend for her life, it has to be said. Second half got underway very similar to the first, dominating and in control. What more can I say? The 54th minute saw our Brazilian centre-back Rafael score a header from a corner. As I mentioned before, we were trying a lot of creative short set pieces, but this was textbook stuff. Great ball in from Meade on the right-hand side, which Rafael got a perfect, perfect contact on, and the keeper really had no chance. It was a perfect header. And we were 3-0 up, so the Emirates absolutely erupted when it was announced that over 53,000 tickets had been sold. Over 47,000 had attended, smashing the previous WSL record of 39,000. It was only a few moments later when Miedema put the cherry on top of the cake. From another set piece worked absolutely expertly, Ford put in a great ball which found the WSL all-time's highest score in plenty of space. She headed the ball expertly into the back of the net and the game ended 4-0 to the Arsenal. A historic day in the Emirates, and hopefully we will have many, many more. So just having a look at some of the stats, Arsenal enjoyed 69% of possession compared to Spurs' 31. We had 4 shots on target compared to their 1, 7 off compared to their 2. And we enjoyed 14 corner kicks and they only had 1. I think the stats were a fair reflection on the game. Spurs really struggled against us. They didn't get a single chance. We were completely, completely on top of them, in control. And dominant, our favourite words. Hopefully we can take that form into our game on Wednesday versus Ajax. It really is a crunch match this early on in the season to secure Champions League football. If we stick to the league though, Arsenal really do look like the team to beat. We are in complete control of all our games. Even if we're not that clinical, we're winning games super convincingly, super, super convincingly. One stat that might blow your mind is Zinsberger has managed to keep a record number of 8 consecutive clean sheets. 8 consecutive clean sheets, okay? She has broken the record that was previously set at 7. I think they've scored 30 goals since we've last conceded. Really, we are on fire in this league. And considering Chelsea and City's performances so far, it looks like it's in our hands. So, of course, the main focus of the day was the record-breaking crowd who attended. But let's not forget to congratulate Beth Mead and Katie McCabe, who both made their 100th appearance for Arsenal in the WSL. Jordan Nobbs came on as second-half substitute to make her 150th appearance in the WSL. That is the most by any player for a single club in the competition's history. That's all for me this week. Thank you so much for listening and I'll be back next week to give you some updates on how we got on versus Ajax. Hopefully good. I can't take heartbreak this early on in the season. Thanks very much for listening and I'll see you then. Bye.
It's time to enter the gun room for a natter.
Hi, welcome to the gun room. I've got the party hat on again. All will be revealed, as I normally say. The last pod was certainly eventful and entertaining. Jay came up with the word truncated, which was quite a good word, wasn't it? Nice and chewy. Nick came up with the phrase, it's not our first time at the rodeo. And myself and Lauren couldn't tell Brentford from Bournemouth. And he said, Bradford then? It's starting again. It's the bees.
We don't need another one in the mix, okay? I think 2 is enough.
Hold on, he's coming. He's coming. Hi, Nick. We'll introduce you properly in a minute. Give us a sec. Can you hear us?
Yeah.
Cool. Right then, so there's no pressure tonight. All the fluffs and the fuffs and all that sort of thing. With us is Jay. How are you, Jay?
Hello, very good, very good.
Another podcasteer, Lauren. How are you?
I'm fantastic, thank you.
And Nick, by the skin of his teeth, in the nick of time. How are you,
guys? Nick? I'm great.
The hat is for Per Mertesacker. It's his birthday. Granit Xhaka, it's his birthday. Kenny Sanson was 64. And Emmanuel Petit, it was his birthday as well. So we get that out of the way. There's no Paul in the gun room, but he should be back. I said to him on the podcast today, when are you back? And he said, I can't come back because I've got some gig to go to, someone out of some group or another. So he won't be back for another week. Nick, we could keep you busy. No men's football, but there was a North London derby to relieve the monotony of the international break as Arsenal took on Spurs in a WSL. Injuries have been a big feature of this week. There's been a lot of chat about it. Thomas Partey and Kieran Tierney. Now, the general consensus, not that I go with that, but the general consensus is flog them off. Nick, you've just come in late and we're going to test you now, mate. What's your opinion?
It's really easy to get frustrated at these guys because of their injuries and kind of forget what kind of player they are. But you get to a point where kind of where we're at in the rebuild, it's like, how much can you depend on these guys to be around? I mean, we saw injuries absolutely derail our season when we were flying going into that last international break, and missing a couple of those guys right after it, and we just couldn't cope. So
is that you again, Jay?
Sorry.
He's doing it week on week out now, isn't he? Carry on, Nick.
It's Durban as well.
Sorry. Carry on, Nick.
He probably got an email from the physio with the latest updates. But yeah, I mean, the Thomas Partey one is the most concerning to me, just because when we have him, we're an elite team. But when we don't, we are scrambling. I mean, I love Sambi, and I see that he has a skill set within him, but he's just not there. And I don't know if there's many guys that can do what Thomas Partey can. And that changes Granit Xhaka's role, and he's been tremendous in the free role he's had. So having him be more responsible defensively changes kind of everything. So that's the one I'm most concerned about. And part of me thinks maybe Mikel's playing some 4D chess and getting some of these guys back early, and we won't know until the lineup comes out. I don't know. I wouldn't put that past him.
Yeah, he could be doing a bit of ducking and diving. Lauren, what's your take? Sell, keep, just ignore? I mean, Thomas Partey makes us a better side for sure. And Kieran Tierney was coming back to fitness. I don't really know the ins and outs of that situation. Mm. But I think it's a bit of a knee-jerk reaction at this stage of the season. We should knuckle down. Your opinion?
Yeah, I just to go back to that point that Nick made, I didn't watch the Ireland game when he was taken off. It was Scotland-Ireland. He came off that game. But I heard he was just taken off because of concussion. So I don't think it was a typical Tierney injury. I think it was more precaution. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was just more of a preactive reaction, if that makes, or preactive action rather than a reactive one, calling them back due to injury. In terms of selling them, I think it's way too early to be talking about that. We don't know how it's going to pan out. Better to have them there. Obviously, Partey is on whopper wages, so maybe that is something that is a bit of a pushing point there. But I wouldn't be jumping to the conclusion that they have to go straight away, you know.
Funny thing was, he was relatively injury-free, wasn't he, until he joined the Arsenal. And then we sorted him out. We made him have crutches and all sorts. Jay, have we got to look for additional cover in January with these two?
Most probably, yeah. You certainly wouldn't sell them until you get any, you know, some sort of, you know, either a better option or another option. Because, you know, I mean, I can't really add too much to what the other guys have said. They're both key members of the squad, but they can't be relied upon at the minute. And you live in hope that they were all precautionary. Well, both of them were precautionary measures just to take them off. But they can't be relied upon, sadly. And especially Thomas Partey, who's, you know, such a key member of the team in such a key area of the pitch. I think it makes perfect sense if, and I'm sure they are, Arteta and Edu and the rest of them are looking at replacements or different options, because they can't be relied upon, can they? Sadly. So yeah.
I think one of the most common phrases is made of glass. And then Nick came up with Thomas Part-Time, which I quite liked.
Yeah, I like that.
That was a good one. Going back a few years to Usmanov, Alisha Usmanov, is being investigated for money laundering now. I just want to see where we were back then before we found out about the funny money and the dirty stuff. I was actually thinking he was our white knight. He was going to ride into North London Central and sort all this mess out with the Cronkies and buy them out. Obviously, that's turned sour, but I'm glad I didn't jump ship, or Arsenal didn't jump ship. Jay, what was your thoughts back then?
No, I'm very similar to you. You know, I kind of thought, if you can't beat him, join him. You know, if you know, Abramovich was coming in, and, you know, Chelsea before Abramovich were not the force that they have been for the last 20 years, to say the least. You know, Abramovich came in, changed the whole landscape of the Premier League with the spending, and, you know, brought in Mourinho. And then a bit later on, you've got Sheikh Mansour's money, and we were at the time, especially with Abramovich taking over, you know, Arsene and the club were moving into position to maybe supersede United, you know, and we were in a winning trophies, getting to cup finals, and we were, you know, being consistently, you know, we were viewed as an actual, you know, genuine elite club, you know, at the top of the league, and then obviously that changed with the Russian money. So at the time when Usmanov was flirting with the idea of buying the club, I mean, I don't think he was ever close to, you know, buying Kroenke out. I think, but I agree with you. I wanted, like every football club, you don't want to be left behind. You don't, any football fan, you don't want to be left behind. And I think for a long time, we were. There's absolutely no doubt we couldn't live with the spending of Chelsea and obviously City later on. So I was the same as you. But you know, in hindsight, it's not a surprise, is it? You know, because I think even all the way along, you know, there were rumours that he was a bit dodgy, to say the least. You know, and his business dealings, he didn't have the best reputation in the world. So it's not a surprise that he's being investigated.
It's time, Nick, isn't it, that the FA did their homework, because they must have known that there was something a bit smelly about that sort of Roman Abramovich, and that they still let him come in. And then they let Usmanov in as well. It's time they tightened up, isn't it?
Yeah, you think so. But then you have the whole Newcastle takeover, and there's a lot of unknowns and question marks about that. And you see and hear about sports washing, and that's kind of a newer term. And but I think the league just sees the dollar signs and just another owner and just more and more money coming in. And it's almost turned a blind eye. And then when it gets real bad, then we'll do something. I was talking to my friends about the Abramovich thing, trying to explain it. And they're like, well, how is the government doing something about a business and just stepping in that way? And just tried to explain it. And they're like, I still don't understand how or why.
You missed them. Nick, it's always when you talk, he's got some sort of grudge going
on. Yeah, got that on a timer, so. I see how it is.
I think the thing is the Premier League is massive, and it needs these massive investors to come in. And it's kind of turned a blind eye, hasn't it? It's kind of swept it under the carpet. Lauren, anything to add on that? It's still a bit of a smelly mess. And there's lots more clubs in the future, probably in the next 12 months, that are going to see dollar signs and be taken over, I guess.
Absolutely. And the only thing I had on that was, it's five words, but we could do a whole podcast on this. Is there such a thing as an ethical billionaire? And that's the kind of investment that we're talking about, to come in to take over one of these clubs. Of course, I mean, you know, there's different levels of evil and this, that, the other. But, you know, I think if we start investigating one thing, it's going to open a can of worms. And they really need to have a structure in place to be able to implement it. They can't just start picking out. You know, obviously what happened to Chelsea was a different situation, and that was almost out of their control. They had to do something about that. But I think in terms of, you know, investigating where the money's coming from, it would have to be a completely league-wide, even further, you know, to make sure that, you know, it isn't just all sports washing, or that it is being done above board. So, yeah, it's definitely a difficult one that I don't have the answer to.
Oh, none of us do. Bukayo Saka has been named England's Men's Player of the Year, 21-22. He came on in the England game and livened up the whole affair. Three assists as well. Other than that, I mean, I know I'm straying off the Arsenal subject, but it was a pretty dull match, Jay.
Yeah, I mean, there was also the game before where Southgate played Saka at left wing back, you know, like... Come
He's
on.
Going to put him in goal next time. trust me, I've got a beard.
Yeah, he's. I mean, England are such a funny entity, aren't they? Or they're always one or two games away from a crisis, or one or two games away from being the best thing ever. You know, you live in fear. Even just watching the game last night, Saka pulling up, you know. Couple of days before the North London Derby, you know, I don't want him involved. Didn't want him involved. I was glad that Ben White was left out. And I mean, you look at the, I don't want to talk about England too much, but you look at Harry Maguire, and he's really struggling at the moment, and how Ben White can't get picked ahead of some, you know, Maguire. I mean, I'm not going to jump on the bandwagon and really slate Maguire too much. He's just really struggling. He needs to break from the England team. Ten Hag's done the right thing and dropped him out of the United side. And I'm sure Maguire will come back and he's just really struggling, and he's constantly making mistakes, isn't he? And he's so from that point of view, I was glad that Ben White wasn't in there. But Saka more than deserves that player of, you know, England's player of the year. He's, you know, he should be starting for England every game. It shows. Even he hasn't started the season as badly as most have made out this year, but he's fully deserved that. And I'm sure come Saturday lunchtime, he'll be raring to go against that lot.
On a trivial side, I've got to say that if there was a competition for the shirts, Germany won it hands down. What a classy shirt. I'm not so sure about the England one. But Nick, what's happening to the US shirt, USA? That looks like it's just like an explosion in a paint factory. Shame on you, sir.
It's awful. It's awful. And the performances in it have matched it. So it'll be an interesting group for all of us.
Right, guys, I've got to bust it up a little bit before we get onto the WSL. Has anyone seen Inside Hale End? What did you make of it? Who wants to go first? Don't all fight for it. Lauren, I'm picking you, Lauren.
Yeah, no worries. So I haven't finished it yet, actually, unfortunately. I'm about two episodes in, and I started watching it with my other half, who wasn't here this weekend. And obviously, there's a bit of a strict rule, can't watch ahead in anything, whatever it may be. But we were really enjoying it. We actually got the inspiration to watch it from Channel 4's The Academy, which was based on Crystal Palace, I believe, last season or the season before. So it was really nice to see that after having seen the ins and outs of another Premier League team. So I'm looking forward to finishing it. So not too many spoilers, please.
I tell you what I did do is I fell in love with the club all over again, because the way they were treating the youngsters, the way they were trying to give a duty of care, because in my mind, I think I saw a documentary some time ago, and it was just a bit of a slaughterhouse, really. If you didn't make the grade, you were dumped off, and there was no aftercare. There was no consideration for the broken dreams and all that sort of thing. So the way the Arsenal guys in the small bits, it's like an episode and a half, really enjoyed seeing Arsenal being classy, doing the right thing. And I was so impressed as well. Nick, did you see any of it?
Yeah, I'm only an episode in. So I've got a lot of work to do, but just I love that the club is getting more people that know the club back into the club. I mean, you see that with Mikel Arteta, you see that with Edu, but giving Murta Saka the reins with this, I thought was a masterstroke. And I don't think we'll see the benefits of it for 5 to 10 years. But I just love him as a leader. He speaks so well. And that's why I really like Mikel at the helm, because he's so well-spoken. I think he really has an aura about him that captivates a room. And I see that same aura in Per Mertesacker, and it's pretty cool how they were both brought in at the same time, and so they obviously have similar characteristics about their personality, but also know each other. So I think it'll create a great pipeline. But I'm excited to see more because I mean I played all through those ages, not in academy, but just interesting seeing how I work with teenage students at a school, so kind of seeing how people that age are treated, what they need, and maybe in this generation. Saw a glimpse of that and excited to see more.
Well, it was funny that Nwanyeri got his couple of minutes, and then when I watched Hale End, there he was again. So I did it the wrong way around. I should have gone the other way around. Jay, it's clear that Arsenal are putting in a strong foundation at every single level, which bodes well for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've watched, I think I'm on about episode 5 or 6, and I won't spoil it for anybody, but one of the main things I was most impressed with was the detail of analysis for each age group's training. sessions were just like, I just didn't expect it. To be honest, I didn't really know what to expect, because it's very rare that you get chance unless you're involved, you know, if you've got a family member or, you know, your friend or whatever who's involved with any football club, Premier League club at that level. I think it's difficult because, like, my nephew was part of the Nottingham Forest under 15s, and I used to go training with him. And they've got a good setup, Forest have, but it is not on that level, you know. And it's the level of care that those players. I mean, at Forest, don't get me wrong, that they it's a great setup, but just from what you see on Inside Hale End, you know that the coaches are very well drilled right from the top, from Mertesacker. You know, the message gets conveyed really well through the coaches and the players. You know, they seem like pretty nice young gentlemen, and obviously you don't see them full. You don't see the full side of them. You only get a small snippet of what they're like. But I really enjoyed the program. Really enjoyed the show. You want to be back at that age and being involved in it. You know, because we all love football and we all played. You know, at certain levels, but you know, to be involved with a club like Arsenal, it must be super disappointing. But it was good to see. And again, I don't want to spoil it, but the aftercare when it doesn't work out for some players was really encouraging, because you don't want them to be just left with the disappointment of being at a club like Arsenal for X amount of years, and then to have it all taken away from you at a point where you're leaving school and you're leaving your friends and stuff. It was really encouraging to see that they were looked after, and the coaches seemed to care, you know, because there wasn't that cutthroat goodbye, we won't see you, you know, good luck. But they seemed to care. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. It's a really great program, and a really good program to watch after All or Nothing, you know, because it gives you a little bit more. It's,
look at us all nodding there. Yeah, yeah, we're all nodding.
I was just thinking that as well, I promise.
Yeah. It's not, you know, All or Nothing's the glitz and the glamour, but this features the parents and their sacrifices to a certain extent. And yeah, I loved it. Really, really great show.
I think it's a very clever ploy, as Nick touched upon. It's like bringing you right inside the heart of the club. And we've seen it at the senior level, and now we're seeing it through the other levels. So it's a brilliant thing to do. Right, Lauren, bring us up to speed before we go to North London Derby. Bring us up to speed on the crazy happenings in Spain. There are just...
Yeah, there seems to
off
be something
scale,
every week,
they?
Doesn't there, from coming from Spain? But yeah, so this week...
Too much sun.
Yeah, that must be it. this week it was announced that 15 of the women's national team players had made it public to the Royal Federal Football, yada yada, Spain's FA, that they wanted a change of manager. Basically saying if their current manager, George Vilda, don't know him.
I'll take word for it.
Step down, yeah, always trust me, I know what I'm doing. I try anyway. If he doesn't step down, that they are going to step back from their national duties. Now, this is just after a summer of a pretty disappointing Euros for Spain. Granted, I think they were probably England's best competition apart from Germany in the final. They're amazing players. We're really talking about world-class players here, Champions League level. They should be getting to the finals of these, you know, World Cups, Euros as well. And we have the World Cup coming up next summer. So that's the real pressure. That's why they're saying that they want him to step down. Now, the reason they're saying this is because he creates a very toxic culture within the team. It's affecting their performance and their mental health. In response to this, the Spanish FA came out and said, basically, that's fine. Step down if you want to. We're not going to be blackmailed. And I mean, we're talking about players who play with United, Barcelona, City. It's not second string players. This is like, it could be their whole starting 11 who said, we are not comfortable playing in these conditions. You know, something has to give. So it's a bit crazy. I mean, I can't think of, I mean, you think of maybe Premier League.
Are they trying to work this out, Lauren? Are they trying to solve this as we speak?
They basically, as far as I'm up to date with, they just said, you know, this is it. If you don't want to play, you don't want to play, and that's it. It's up to you. So, wow. yeah, it's crazy. And I think, you know, you think of teams like teams like United, where players might have an issue with the manager.
I thought you were going to say Bournemouth.
No, not today. Keeping that far out of my mind. Teams like, you know, United, where they have issues with the manager and players might get a bit stroppy, but no one's throwing their contracts up in the air saying, I'm not playing until this person's gone. So you just have to think of the level of, you know, discomfort and dissatisfaction that exists within that team for 15 of them to step up and say, you know what, we can't hack this anymore. So it's pretty crazy. And I think it is a really good reflection on the FA, who are putting so much effort and so much time and so much, you know, love and care into the women's side in England. So, you know, we're looking at two very, very stark contrasts as women's football is exploding really at exponential rates. We have one body who's ready to throw the kitchen sink at it to make sure that it gets the love it deserves. And then you look at Spain, which unfortunately it isn't the case. So, yeah.
Well, North London Derby then, 53,737 tickets sold at the Emirates. Arsenal have now won their last 10 matches, scoring 95 goals and conceding just twice. Their clean sheet was the eighth in a row. What did you make of that performance, Lauren? It was a great and solid performance against that lot.
Yeah, I mean, there's really not that much to say. It was just exceptional, really. We were in control of the whole game. I don't think they even managed a shot on target. And if they did, probably against the run of play. But it felt more of a comfortable game than the Brighton game did, which I think is correct. Yeah, we did play Brighton in the opening fixture.
Hey!
I'm getting good now. Third time lucky. But it was just that kind of atmosphere. At no point did Arsenal look threatened. I think 4-0, it might sound a bit ridiculous, but it was a little bit flattering to Spurs because we could have had 6-7-8. You know, we are lacking a slight... It sounds ridiculous, but we're lacking just that really clinical touch to capitalize on all the chances we're creating.
Yeah, because that's the second domestic game where we've kind of missed out on about six goals overall, isn't it? We just seem to be able to walk into the Spurs penalty box whenever we fancy it. It was a bit like a no-show, wasn't it, for their defense?
Yeah, I think the issue was really in the midfield. They were just getting absolutely outrun. They could not compete with Little, with Balti, who are playing there. They just couldn't get past the halfway line, really. Defensively, I thought they were pretty solid in the first half, apart from obviously the big blunder. But I thought they did okay, you know, considering we had a lot of corners from blocked shots and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, you know, they did all right.
Beth Mead got first goal after 5 minutes. Wonderful strike. Viv Miedemar after 44 minutes. That was a one-on-one with the keeper. 54 minutes, Souza extended Arsenal's lead, and then Miedemar got number four from a short corner. Who was your player of the match?
Ooh, again, I thought Ford, we mentioned her last week. She had a great game as well. She's creating a lot of chances. But I think, you know, it really was Beth Mead's day. Even when she got subbed off, she did a kind of half lap of honour and the standing ovation she got. There just seems to be an aura about her at the moment. We're two games into the WSL. She's three goals scored, lost count of the assists, but you know, it just really does seem like it's going to be her season this season. So fingers crossed it keeps going that way.
I wonder if Miedemar was listening to this podcast, because we said she had a quiet game and she upped her game, obviously. Now I asked the guys, because of North London Derby coming up at the weekend, I asked them to think of their favourite games and moments where we'll kind of go round on sweep, see what you come up with. Nick?
Yeah, my first memory as a supporter was the Bentner goal, him coming on with that towering header and his first touch, and the Emirates erupted, and I was really hooked after that. And at that point, I didn't really realise what that game meant, but looking back, I mean, it's still probably a top five favorite goal for me all time, just because the nostalgia for me, kind of the beginning of my fanhood. So that one, that was 2007, had some great goals in that as well. Both of the 5-2 games, both tremendous. specifically the one that we came from behind. Sanya with the bullet header, some great goals. I mean, if you score in this game, you become a cult hero. And you just remember those goals and you replay them all the time. So the Van Persie goals, the Rosicki goals, Mertesacker. But probably my favorite was the 2018 4-2 game. We came from behind. Dyer and Kane scored for them. Dyer was winding up Aaron Ramsey on the bench, and Ramsey came on at halftime. And
I do love a bit of that, all that argy bargy on the sidelines. So, you know, see the passion. That's what we want to see as football fans.
Gotta have it. And I hope we see some this weekend. I think you have to have that in a game like this, and to have that and then to go on to win in the fashion that we did was, you can't ask for much more than that.
I just have to say, Granit, take it easy, mate. Don't go in full clog, okay? I'm going to kick off with Thierry Henry, 16th of November 2002, the legendary goal. It was credited as an assist by Patrick Vieira, who was up in his own penalty area or just outside, punted it through to Henry, and Henry just skipped and danced with that. It's kind of like, as he's going along, he changes the speed of his step. And he just jigged and danced through. And you just thought, he's going to go in a minute. He's going to cock his leg back and that'll be it. It was a fantastic goal. And we got the knee slide, courtesy of the statue outside. So that's one of my standout. It still is a standout moment for me. Jay?
Just trying to find where you told me we were going to go over this. You're still not sending me stuff, are you, Tom?
Yes, yeah, I sent it all out. Did you not get it?
It's in your email that you keep getting.
Did you not get it?
No.
Sorry, mate.
Nobody play. So many
he's
great.
He's got an encyclopedic memory, so he'll be all right. Look at him, mate. Especially against that lot.
Yeah, so many great memories. Probably the one of the ones that sticks out for me is back at Highbury when it was throwing it down the rain. I can't remember the year, but Ian Wright was right on the far touchline. He crossed it to the back post and Bergkamp was there, took it down with his first touch, cut back across himself and put it in the bottom corner. And he's on his knees and he's in the rain, just perfect. But so many great memories, you know, slightly more recent, you know, at the old White Hart Lane when Fabregas scored and then Adebayor scored with a turn on the lovely first touch from Fabregas, ball back to goal, flicked it up, bang, straight in the top corner. Rosicky at the old White Hart Lane in the first couple of minutes.
See what I mean, Nick? He's got all this. He pretends like we've blown him out, but he's got it all there.
So he knows. So he's
many,
fine.
So many. But it's. I think this weekend, you know, it's. I can't think of a game from a league point of view that has been where the teams are doing so well. You know, like, and it's so much is riding on it, and like. Like Nick said, you have to have that passion in games like this. And I mean, obviously I worry about our players getting sent off. You know, I don't know why. I've got a feeling that they might target Saliba. Kane might be, you know, like basically trying to, because he's young and because he's potentially got a bit of a fiery side and he hasn't experienced this game before. I've got a horrible feeling that Kane's going to be up to his old tricks.
Well, they're very good at the shithousery, aren't they? Because that's what they do. They try and get under your skin and maul you about a bit, put you off your stride, because they're not skillful. That's the problem.
No, but I just it's such a huge game, and if we manage to win, which I fully expect us to win, absolutely, like I said last week, then it puts us in a great position. But I mean, so many great memories. We could make a podcast just on this fixture,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, you could.
But yeah, Bergkamp for me, in front of the North Bank, absolutely.
Bergkamp. Oh, yeah. Lauren, got any little memories you want to share with us? We're doing our heroes at the minute. We'll try and find a villain in a minute.
No, do you know what? I'm also going to go with the 5-2 in 2012. It was when we came back. I think that was Adebayor's first time back in a Spurs shirt, if I am correct to remember that. So that was the kind of, you know, heightened drama in that edition. He obviously got the penalty. 2-0 up, and then we came back in just expert fashion, and it was, I always just remember that one. That's the first one that sticks out to me, and when I think of this fixture, that's the one that always jumps out at me. Again, like Nick, obviously I didn't grow up in North London. I had no idea about this fixture until I got Twitter. So maybe like a year or two before, I kind of started realizing, okay, actually, yeah, this is a local derby as opposed to being, you know, a United or Chelsea, whatever it was. So I didn't really put too much importance on it before because they weren't very good. Didn't know the history behind it. But yes, that's the one that always sticks out at me. And, you know, if we could have another, you know, even last season, the 3-1 win, that really seemed to be the turning point of, you know, our luck, our run of form last season. So, you know, it's obviously, it's a big game, but we're more than capable. And I believe in all the players on the pitch out there.
I tell you what this game does bring is a different kind of atmosphere for me. I don't know whether any of you guys agree, because when you go to the stadium and you're playing anyone in particular, it's a great atmosphere. It really is. It tends to get better with different teams. But against Spurs, I mean, it makes the hairs on your neck stand up. You just, and you have a little shiver as well. Anyone experienced that, Jay?
I've never been to a North London derby. I know, but I've been to quite a few games. I don't know if you guys remember, it was the first game of the season a couple of years back. We played West Ham and we lost 2-0. It was when Reece Oxford played centre midfield for West Ham and he absolutely bossed it. And me and my son, we were sat about two or three rows from the West Ham fans. And I mean, we were obviously in the clock end, right at the back. And like I say, they were literally right there. And it was, but we've been in the ground. We've played, I mean, we've been to many, many games, City at home. We went to Chelsea at home and it was a great atmosphere. Like you said, very similar that we went to the game. That was Mikel's first home game when Tammy Abraham scored in the last minute. And we played so well. I don't know if you remember.
You have to excuse me. Something's fallen off the table. Hold on.
But we played so well that game and didn't get anything from it. That was a great atmosphere. But it's definitely a game that I'd love to go to at home. I'd love to go to the away fixture as well. I think it would be intense. You know, again, another memory, Aaron Ramsey at Wembley, you know, scoring and this is my ground. You know, that kind of, you love that, don't you? That's just, you know, just brilliant. And like you said, Tom, it's a different atmosphere, but it must be so intense to play in. You know, it must be, you know, you're literally on the edge, aren't you? You know, from a, you know, red card. We've seen so many red cards down the years, some warranted, some not so. But I mean, I told you before I came on that I'm in London and I'm fingers crossed somebody can sort me out a ticket on Saturday. I'm not holding my breath, but, you know, I've got a few friends trying to get me some tickets. So fingers crossed.
Well, hopefully we'll pump this out fairly sharpish and you might get a contact through that. Lee Dixon actually said when he arrived at Arsenal, he was getting ready for a North London derby. Have you heard this one? And he looked round just before kickoff, and some of the guys were looking at him. I take it he means Mr. Adams. I won't do the Strictly theme or anything like that. But and he thought, what's going on? And they came up to him, cornered him, and kind of said, you best play well today. So that's the sort of intensity within the dressing room. So Christ knows it's going to be full on. Other kind of dates stand out. 2004, we got a 2-2 draw to win the league at White Hart Lane, which is always a plus. And Tottenham 0 Arsenal 1 on the 3rd of May 1971. Ray Kennedy scored an 87th minute header to win the first division title. Should also add about Lucas Torreira as well, because I know he didn't really do much for us, but that goal against Tottenham in the 4-2 in 2018 was something else.
Lovely.
So let's have a little think about villains. Mine is for the natural reason that he used to play for us, threw toys out of the pram, buggered off over to them. It's Emmanuel Adebayor. Couldn't stand him while he was at Arsenal. He was a cocky SOB. But when he went there, it was just like he did it for spite. He just really pissed me off. And I've never liked him since. Jay, have you got any villains?
Yeah, Adebayor is right up there. You know, like, oh, God. I mean, he's the first one that comes to mind.
Isn't he just, yeah.
Ask one of the other. I'll have a think if you just...
Nick, any villains apart from Mr. Adebayor? He seems to be getting all votes at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, William Gallus did the same thing. Similar type of character.
Good point.
Quite brash, and feel like he did it for the spite as well. Hard not to pick Harry Kane, just because he seems to...
Pictures of him as a lad in an Arsenal shirt, and then he's banging on like his heart's full of Tottenham. Scumbag.
Yeah. It's, I mean, he can bumble around in these England games and not show much of anything. And then, you know, come Saturday, he'll find a way to, get three touches and three, looks on goal. I won't say goals, but I'll say maybe looks. So, yeah, I mean, he's been the pantomime villain for the last couple of years and has earned his reputation as a goal scorer, and he really loves these games. So, yeah, public enemy number one for me.
Lauren, got any people you love to hate? Or have we covered them all?
I think you've covered them all. I'm just I'm really trying to think. But, like, you know, I mean, obviously I could say, you know, people like, you know, Robbie Keane. I just was watching the Ireland game there before I came in, and Doherty was playing.
That celebration, what was that about?
I couldn't answer you, but it was always, you know, you're cheering for them in the national team, and then as soon as you see them at club level, you're thinking, oh, and it doesn't really happen that often in the Premier League for Irish players, not anymore anyway. So they're the kind of last ones I can think of at big clubs. So yeah, I'm just gonna have to put them there for personal spite, if that's all right.
That's welcome. I'm a little bit worried, guys, about the Saliba situation. It's still hanging about. I don't think Mikel Arteta thinks there's much of a rush. He was hooked off in the French defeat. What are we making of this situation? What are we making of him getting hooked off? I didn't think they weren't playing brilliantly, but he wasn't the worst player on the pitch. Jay?
Yeah.
Nick?
Go Lauren? For it.
Go ahead, Jay.
Go for it, mate. You go.
I was going to say, I saw that too, and I wouldn't be... I'm not too worried about that, and maybe it was something already planned just for his age and maybe the amount of minutes he's had. But yeah, he's shown that he can do it at that level, and I'm confident he'll make the trip. I don't know if he'll start for France, but I think he's in the squad, and you know, I'd like to think Deschamps knows what he's getting, and hopefully this was more of a managing minutes. I mean, it's a bad look, and hopefully doesn't take a blow to his confidence because, yeah, like you said, it's a big weekend. Hopefully they don't target him, but I'd rather have Saliba out there than Rob Holding. So I'll say that.
I've got to be honest, if his confidence hasn't been knocked by being loaned out, you know, for his initial spell, and then sort of his future was up in the air, then I don't think anything is going to phase that lad at all. No news on the Saka signing either. That's a little bit of a worry, but apparently they are in discussions. We're just going to finish off here with, we're going to have another stab at the predictions because we were all a bit reticent. We'll put that in the beginning at the next one. We were a bit reticent about the scoreline. I'm going to go for 3-1. Nick?
I like 3-1. I'm going 3-2. Late winner. I'm going all the drama.
Oh, hey, I would love that.
Plus a red card. I don't know which side, but I'm going for everything.
Yeah, well, like it, Nick. Lauren, we know you're a bit sketchy on these. You don't really like doing them since the last one, but it's looming. We've really got to come up with the goods here. Powerful, positive energy.
I think, you know, I think having watched the women over the weekend, my confidence might be a bit inflated. I think I might be going 3-0.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is radical. Mind you, it gave us a good vibe, didn't it, going into this one? Yeah, Jay, absolutely. Have you revised your opinion?
I'm going to go, yeah, I agree with Nick. Red cards, definitely. I think there'll be penalties. I think I think there'll be loads of goals. I think we're 4-2 to the Arsenal.
Well, that is a big one. Right, we will be coming back next week with the North London Derby and we'll tell you who got the red card. It's got to be Xhaka, isn't it? Because he's got his birthday. He'll have a red card for that.
He's changed these days.
Yeah.
He's not that changed. Guys, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks very much. It's been brilliant as always. And we got through this one without too many hiccups. See you next time. Nick, thanks especially. We'll be in touch. See if we can get you back in.
Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
See you later, guys.
Myself and Dave were having a chat over a cuppa. If they ever did away with the North London Derby, what could we replace it with? Well, Big Tony Adams has adopted the soft shoes and the sequins for Strictly Come Dancing. Are you going to do that every time I say Tony Adams? Stop it. So what about an NLDO, a North London dance-off? We chose Gabby Jesus and Mikko Arteta, old Spanish Michael. Gabby's into the shoulder jiggle and the hip wiggle, and Mikel looks like he could definitely bust a move. But what about for that lot? How about flat-footed, bungle-brained, empty-headed, knock-kneed Eric Dier and hapless Harry Kane, the only England captain in living memory to get us relegated from a competition? Bobby Moore will be turning in his grave, sir. Harry Kane could dance the Paso Doble. I'd love to see him say that. Break out the Sou'westers!
It's an Arsenal thing, it's an Arsenal thing. Believe it or not, it's an Arsenal thing. With football and transfers, you know who you'll bring. You're listening to It's an Arsenal thing.
Connor delivers a player profile on Abu Dhabi and what might have been.
It's an Arsenal Thing podcast, player profile time again. No going to get into it, men's match report, of course, this week due to the international break. But here is my latest player profile edition. And today, it's all about the gifted Abu Dhabi and what could have been. His full name, Vasiriki Abu Dhabi. He is still, would you believe, only 36 years of age. He was born on the 19th of May, 1986 in Aubervilliers, a northern eastern suburb of Paris. He was, and still is, considered by many Arsenal supporters and football fans alike as Arsenal's most underrated and underappreciated midfield maestro. The way he glided with the ball was at times simple, but majestic. He really made playing football look effortless at times, with his trademark sliding tackle often reminiscent of an ice skating professional at their very best. Touted by many as the next Patrick Vieira, Dhabi was then signed by Arsene Wenger back in January 2006 from French Ligue 1 outfit Auxerre for €3 million. He wore the number 2 shirt and made 12 Premier League appearances in his debut Premier League season, getting on the score sheet once. He then made his Premier League debut with us on the 21st of January 2006 in a 1-0 away victory at Everton. His standout season in the Premier League with us was undoubtedly the 2009-2010 season, where the gifted midfielder scored 6 times in his 29 league appearances. Then, a defining moment in Diaby's footballing career came on the 1st of May 2006. The first and maybe one of the most significant of his injuries came in a game at Sunderland in his debut season. Diaby was the subject of a horrific tackle during a home win against Sunderland when we had been 3-0 up and cruising to victory. The result of the challenge, a young Diaby had broken his ankle, which would keep him out of action for a further 10 months. From that moment on, injuries were sadly a defining feature of his footballing career. Speaking himself on the injury, Diaby was quoted as saying the following: "At that time, I was only 19 or 20. You get injured and just think, I will get my treatment and go back on the pitch. When I came back on the pitch afterwards, though, I knew that something was different. I lost a lot of flexibility in my ankle. I wasn't as quick and I knew something had changed. I started getting injured often and getting muscular injuries, and it was definitely related to that." Well then, he spent 9 years with us in total, but much of that time was unfortunately marred by injury. Diaby eventually left Arsenal in the summer of 2015, joining Marseille on a free transfer before being released by the French club 2 summers later. He then retired, of course, in 2019. Interestingly, Diaby was quoted in various interviews saying that he did feel some pressure with regards to following in Patrick Vieira's footsteps. During his time as a Gunner, the Frenchman racked up 124 Premier League appearances with us, scoring 14 times and providing 11 assists, 180 appearances in total for the club. Not too bad at all for an injury-struck defensive midfielder. One of the most memorable strikes of his was a clinical finish away to Newcastle at St James's Park on the 21st of March 2009 after a superb give-and-go with Robin van Persie. Anybody remember the 2007 League Cup final? An eventual 2-1 loss to Didier Fecking Drogba and Jose Mourinho's Chelsea in a match where Theo Walcott scored a beauty. Diaby was involved in a horrific clash with John Terry as our man tried to hack a corner clear, only for our Frenchman to catch Terry straight in the face. Terry was knocked unconscious as a result, and Diaby has since revealed that he had feared that he had killed the Chelsea skipper on that day. Incredible stuff. Diaby has certainly been involved in his fair share of injury scares, including that horror clash with John Terry. He earned 16 caps with the French national team, scoring one goal. In total, including for France and his various clubs, Diaby played 224 times, scoring 22 goals and providing 17 assists. He retired in 2019, of course, at the young age of 32. And well, will we ever see a 6'3" defensive midfielder as graceful and as technically gifted as Abu Diaby? Only time will tell. But as Arsenal fans, we're certainly blessed to see him grace an Arsenal shirt. Thank you, Abu Diaby.
It's time to enter the gunroom for a natter.
Hi, welcome to a very, very special gunroom. With us, we have the Arsenal legend, midfielder, and now a book writer. He's a novelist. It's Paul Davis. He needs no introduction, but I'm giving him one anyway. How are you, Paul?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to
pleasure. Absolute pleasure. We've been buzzed up since we got confirmation of you coming on. With us also is Paul. Everyone will know him from the podcast. Paul, we will, of course, talk about your fantastic Arsenal career and obviously the book Arsenal and After with Tom Watt. But tell us your current role, because you've kind of disappeared off the radar a little bit, haven't you? You've seen all the old Arsenal faces doing this, that and the other, Strictly Come Dancing or whatever.
Yeah.
Not tempted, are you?
But No, not tempted. I've been watching it and it's been interesting watch. So, but yeah, my current role, and thanks for having me on, guys. I've really enjoyed sort of talking to fans and podcasts. I've done a few now since the book, and it's been really nice to be able to talk to people that actually gone through your career a lot of it. So I'm looking forward to it. But my current role, and part of the reason I did the book was because that was what people were asking me a lot of, what are you doing now? So people bump into people on the road or on the tube or on the transport, anywhere. And it's like, oh, Paul, well, yeah, how you doing? I remember when you, and I'm like, it's great. People just give you their stories. And it's, you know, as I've got older, I've kind of began to realize the effects that we have as footballers on people's lives. And when you're in it, you don't really appreciate that. You come out of it, and people still come up to you like 30, 40 years later and tell you the minute detail of games and things that you've done. Half of the time, you don't remember. There's players. I mean, I speak to a lot of colleagues that don't remember stuff, but they speak to fans and the fans remember everything. So it's fascinating me over the years bumping into fans, them asking me different things about my career, what happened there, why did you do that, why did the manager decide to do that. So there's a lot of questions that fans want to know about. When they go,
I'll be honest, Paul, we're not going to vary from that either.
Yeah. No, that's great. Yeah, because I think you know, it's interesting stuff, really. A lot of the stuff that don't get talked about is, for me actually, is the interesting stuff. You know, everybody knows and sees the visual, but there's things underneath. And I think what I wanted to do with the book, Tom and I and the publishers wanted to kind of get a little bit underneath stuff. And we spent a lot of time going over it and wanting to answer some of the questions that fans have been asking me. And one of those questions is like, what are you doing now, Paul? So yeah. I'll talk about it. Essentially, I'm still in the game. I've been in the game from when I was a player or young apprentice, and I've managed to stay in the game, which is an achievement in itself. Look, I look at it now, it is an achievement. Not many stay in the game after playing. So I do feel I've been lucky, but I've had to work hard to do well. So my role now is with the English FA. I've re-educated myself. I've become a senior professional game coach developer. So essentially, that is developing the game's next generation of coaches at the senior game. And so hence my connection with Mikel Arteta, one of many that I've been involved with their development. That's my kind of role within the FA. And so I talk about my role, my current role, how I've got to that point. So from finishing playing, after finishing my coaching, and then getting into coach development. And I think we've tried to cover, and that's why it's called Arsenal and After. We wanted to cover that bit afterwards because people don't know that bit.
It's quite a gap, isn't it, Paul?
Yeah.
There's a lot to put in.
Yeah, there is a lot. And we felt that it was something that fans, particularly Arsenal fans, and I think you know, football fans generally will find interest in my career or in footballer's career, what happens after you finish playing. So, you know, the book does cover that. Now, we're really pleased with it. It was a long process, sort of 9 to 12 months, Tom and I. And the good thing, like, Tom and I knew each other before this. So I think we got more out of it because we were able to have frank and honest conversations, and that's what it was. Because I knew that he understood what I was saying, and he, you know, there was a good synergy between us, so we were able to produce a good book, I think. And, you know, we got to the publishers who supported us, Reach Sport supported us as well. So, you know, I'm really pleased with it, and the response so far from people that I've read has been really good.
I know Paul's chomping at the bit, but you mentioned Mikel Arteta there. Could you sense that he was going to be the coach he's now becoming? Was there a feeling that he was going to be successful?
Yeah, I talk about the meeting, how I met him. I talk about how once he got enrolled onto the particular course, how sort of relationship and friendship developed from there. And yeah, I think with people like Mikel, who's played at the highest level of the game as a footballer, he's mixing with people like he's mixing with the top people in the game. He's played with some of the top managers, Guardiola, and you know, those there's you'd have to be pretty dumb for none of it to rub off on you. And he's not dumb. And clearly a lot of it's rub. I mean, he worked with Wenger for many years. He's worked with Guardiola. He came through the Barcelona Academy. You know, he's been a great player, got a great career. So you're just naturally going to pick stuff up. And if you're a learning type, which he is, and I saw that straight away, he was going to do something in the game as a manager and a coach. And that's proven. And I saw that very early on, some of the stuff that on the course I was asking him to do. It's clearly just quite easy to do that. So we struck up a good friendship. This was the last year as a player at Arsenal. So I think it was 2016, his last year at Arsenal. And he was keen to get this qualification done before he moved on to the next qualification. And I supported him through that. And I was really, you know, I learned a lot as his sort of mentor. I learned a lot from him because I'd not been in the game for so many years. He's just finished playing the game. So, you know, we were kind of learning off each other. And I was sort of steering him to what the sessions should look like. So in and on the courses, you have to, as a coach, you have to design sessions, you have to organize the sessions, and then deliver sessions and various different sessions. He had to do that. And he did that.
Sometimes you have to keep it fresh as well, Paul, don't you? You can't just go plodding along in the same sort of format.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for me, it's, you know, I'm learning all the time with working with these different players that are coming out of the game, want to go into coaching. They're coming with the modern day ideas that they're coming with. You know, obviously I've done it before. I've done my qualifications, but that was a long time ago. So things have changed and moved on. So I'm learning off of them, and hopefully I'm giving them something to structure what they're doing. So, you know, I do enjoy what I do now. But yeah, coming back to Mikael, yeah, he's the stuff he was producing back then in 2016. He was clearly going to go on to do something. And obviously his contacts with Guardiola at that time, he mentioned that, you know, he had this relationship with Pep and that things might be happening in the future. So there was, you know, he kind of had a pathway mapped out in terms of having support. Yeah, so that's how our friendship, and I'll talk about that in detail in the book, how the relationship developed, the sort of practices that he had to do. And so last year when he had some difficulties at the start, and fans, this time last year, I think, we were like probably bottom Arsenal, and fans weren't so happy. And I always felt that we needed to give him time, and he's starting to produce a team now that most fans are happy with.
Absolutely. I was a pro Arteta, even when it was grubbing, Paul. Right, Paul, do you want to join the party?
Yeah, I do. Hi, Paul. Absolute pleasure. A pleasure to speak to you. Saw you many times in the late 80s and 90s playing at Goodison Park with commanding performances in midfield. So, pleasure to speak to you. And yeah, I really enjoyed the book. I was actually really fascinated by your post-Arsenal career as well. One thing I wanted to ask about was, it seemed from your country at one stage, you were coaching, but then you left Arsenal, so you were struggling to get coaching work. And then suddenly, this opportunity at the PFA came up. Now, I spoke to Paul Power because he worked for the PFA, and he said how much he enjoyed working for the PFA. So from your point of view, how rewarding was it to join the PFA and then be given this like strategic role of developing younger coaches?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think it, and again, I kind of, you know, for people that are listening to this, we're going to some detail on this in the book, because we want people to get a good understanding of, you know, what happens after playing. And this was definitely after playing. And that transition for and trying to get supporters or readers to understand the difficulties of transitioning from playing into something else. And so many players that I've spoken to, myself included, has had those problems. It's difficult problems, how to adjust to normal life, really, because you're coming out of the bubble of being a professional footballer for so many years, and just now you're going to have to like stand on your own two feet. And a lot of players have difficulty with it. I've spoken to many, many players. I had difficulty with it. But PFA, I joined the PFA, Professional Footballers Association, and it was good for me. I was there for such a long time, and they gave me responsibility. They gave me, you know, respect, and they supported me. I got further education off of them. So I've got nothing but admiration for what they did for me. I know some former players are against the PFA. They've had, you know, bad experiences. But yeah, for me, it was, and I remember Paul, I think Paul might have just left the PFA when I joined, I'm not quite sure, but they did talk about Paul. And he was a favourite player of mine, actually.
He was a fantastic professional, Paul. Yeah. You know, he joined us at the age of 33. We thought, you know, he's passed in, and suddenly he ends up being our player of the season.
Yeah, no, I always enjoyed him watching and playing against him. But yeah, PFA was really, really good for me. They developed me. So, you know, coming out of playing with Arsenal, and then I went to Brentford, I talk about that, and then I had some coaching work at Arsenal, and then I left there with a bit of a cloud. Didn't know what I was going to do. Talk about that in the book. Mm. Approached the PFA, and they were so welcoming and made me feel really of value. And as I say, they helped me get further educated.
Yeah.
My qualifications, different skills.
Did you always
really enjoyed it?
Did you always think the PFA developed you in a way that Arsenal should have developed you when you were a coach there?
I think Arsenal definitely at the time with me, they missed the trick. I think, I talk about it quite extensively in the book because that was a big part of my career that was really painful and really difficult to get through. And I couldn't understand at the time how it had come to that, where I, in the end, decided to leave the club that I'd been at and supported from when I was 10 and had so many memories and emotional connection to, decided that I got to leave. So that was really tough. And the whole circumstance around that, which again, people have asked me about over years. I've never really spoken about it because it's very sensitive. A lot of it is sensitive, but we've spoken about it in the book, and I've been as honest and as truthful as I can on my versions of events leading to me leaving Arsenal. And I think fans,
history, Paul, isn't it? He had a lot of history and connections with the club. Following with the. I mean, I used to stand at Highbury and watch you, and we were in awe of you. He's such a cultured player, and then it's kind of taken away from you. It's like the rug's pulled out from under you.
And fans, fans don't know what's gone on, really, to just see stuff. I wasn't one for talking to the media necessarily, so stuff, I always felt that stuff should be dealt with sort of properly, in the family, as it were, things stay in. But I think it was a tight, I got to a stage where people asked me questions, fans were asking me questions. I've got two young lads, in their 20s now, but they didn't know what happened in my career. And so they were asking me questions, and I thought, I've got to a stage in my life where I can share some of what's happened to me, and people will get to hear, if they want to read it, find out about it.
Did you have reservations
in the book? No, I think at first when I first finished, when I was about 35, 40, and people were asking, oh, when are you going to do your book? I thought, it's a little bit, I've just finished playing, really, and I don't really feel to do something so close to finishing because I still want to stay in the game at that point, and I still got aspirations of doing stuff within the game. To do a book at 35, 40, I didn't feel was right, and I kind of just pushed it away. So people did ask me to do a book, and so I've kind of gone past that stage now. I'm sort of getting on in years now, so it's like, and I've got two boys. Like, I think there comes a time where you think, oh, okay, it's right, it's a good time. I felt it was a good time to share some of my experiences, some of the stuff that people have asked me about over the years that I haven't spoken about, and do it in a way that is me. I didn't want to think sensationalize anything. I just wanted it to be just my personality, hopefully comes out in the book, and my thoughts and ideas about the game and what's happened to me in the game, the highs and the lows, because I've had some fantastic highs as well, trophy winnings, all that. you know, 450 games, you know, and you know, some of the things I'm really proud of. One of the things I'm really proud of, and I'll talk about in the book in detail again, is, you know, I was the first black player to make a mark at Arsenal, and like thinking, wow, you know, I didn't think about that at the time, and only after I finished playing that it started to hit home to me that I was that person, and it only hit home to me. I didn't even think about it. It only hit home to me when black fans were coming up to me and saying to me that we support Arsenal because we saw you playing. It didn't register with me at all. But the more and more people came up to me and told me that, the more I thought, okay, well, that's a massive deal. And I look at the Arsenal crowd now, and we are one of the most multicultural crowds in this country. To feel that I've played a part in that is such an unbelievable feeling. And you know, so I can talk about that all that now with a clearer head, and it's fascinating.
So, Paul, I mean, looking back, obviously, when you broke through at Arsenal, as you say, you're the first black player to play for the first team on a regular basis, and you wouldn't have been conscious of how much of a role model you were. But subsequently, when you look back on your career, I guess now you understand that you influenced a whole generation of younger players coming through who saw that you'd made the grade and they could follow in your footsteps.
Hmm. Yeah, that's right, yeah. I think, you know, there's been so many that have come through and have said that to me, and I feel really honoured to have been put in that, you know, in that time that I was and been able to do it, you know. So I've had this opportunity to play for Arsenal, which is a club I supported, which is like another thing, and I've taken that opportunity. But from that has come all this other stuff that you don't really think about, but it's probably more important. And I wanted to kind of start sharing some of that feelings and experiences for anybody that's interested to read. So my, you know, I mentioned my sons there, that, you know, that generation of young person or people that can read it now and kind of get an understanding of things, of where they are in the world and how it's come to be. So I like that, and I think that's what part of the book is about, is to kind of giving people, my son's age groups included, a bit of a more of an understanding of where we are.
So Paul, I mean, is it quite frustrating when you look back in your career, because you played at the time before the wall-to-wall coverage of football on TV. So a lot of your best games, best performances, you know, are really hard for people to access. So do you find that quite frustrating when you try to judge your career against the Premier League generation?
Yeah, I do. It's one of the things I always think about. The games now, I often think that the players now, every one of their games is, they can look back when they retire. They don't know it yet because I've gone down that road. They will be able to look back at every one of their games and be able to tell their story in more clarity than perhaps I've been able to, because I haven't been able to watch reruns of games. So, yeah, without a doubt, the game and the coverage and the, you know, the finance, everything that goes behind has changed it completely. And therefore, the players have got more, you know, they've just got more. They've got more access. They've got more footage. They can do more. Yeah, it's a different game. But I don't begrudge the players. I know how hard it is to stay there, to get there, to stay there. The pressures, and I think that's one of the things. Again, we wanted to get across in the book is the pressures of the game and how that affects you, it affected me on family life. So, yeah, we wanted to kind of just keep the football there, definitely, because that's essentially what people wanted to read about, I feel. But then all these other bits, the pressures, the downsides, the questions that have not been answered properly, So yeah, we've hoped that we've managed to share some of that honestly with the fans.
I think it's more than just a football book about your career, as you say. There's so many facets to your story. You mentioned racism. Did it affect you? Did it make you more determined to succeed as a player?
Yeah, for me, it made me more determined. I think what I did with it, you just try your best to turn the negative situation into positive, and you kind of just learn how to, I don't know how you learn it, you just, I don't know, it's just trial and error, watching others. There's something there that is sort of not tangible, I don't know, you just feel that you need to break through and go beyond this discrimination the struggles of being different. So, you know, I talk about just being the only black player in the change room, the squad of players of 20, you know, who are a lot older than you, who think differently, they've got different, and how you deal with that is really, it's not easy a lot of the time, and how you kind of have to find a way to get through if you're going to make it. So I talk about that, and I think it's important to talk about so that people that don't understand perhaps get a little bit of an understanding, and so that, yeah, we can move forward. So yeah, it's kind of something that's really close to me, all this, because I've lived it, and it's and others will be living it, and hopefully we can all learn from each other. So yeah, that was the main reason behind doing the book, is the sharing and learning, and is to people that might want to be interested to find out.
I think the thing is, most people, Paul, associate your success with George Graham, but you had two really fantastic managers, didn't you, before that, Don Howe and Terry Neill. They were instrumental in your success. Let's talk about your debut. 1980, North London Derby. What a match to put in.
Absolutely,
17
yeah.
years of age.
Amazing. It's just, you couldn't script it. At 17, getting picked in the team to play at White Hart Lane for your first game. Doesn't get much more exciting than that. I'll talk about that and how it came to be, how I felt getting picked, first of all, right, by Terry Neill, how on the team bus driving from Southgate, where we used to meet up as a team before London games, and then we'd drive on the bus to go to White Hart Lane. I talk about the feelings, the emotions going into the change room and changing amongst all these senior players like Liam Brady and Pat Rice, Sammy Nelson, all these guys who were in the team. They were seasoned players, and I was like this little boy from South London, like sort of just different, like just trying to make my way. Yeah, it's amazing. And to actually win the game as well, you know, it's to talk about that. It's great to look back on those memories. It's something special. Playing at White Hart Lane, winning 2-1.
Always a good one, isn't it?
And over the years, as it's gone on, we had great success with George, you know, with winning trophies, and I talk about that, and I talk about, you know, the team, the players that I played with. But there was a period of time when we were beating Spurs 2-1 for, I think this was about eight or nine, it felt like eight or nine seasons, 2-1, 2-1. Remember that fondly. So yeah, there's some great bits in the book that a lot of fans will remember, the games, the scores, but we try to go into like the feelings of the games, the feeling that I felt going into the games, winning in the Cup Winners' Cup in 94, we talk about that. We talk about all the major wins, the Lords Cup. Yeah, so hopefully people...
Did it go very, very quickly? Can you really recall that debut, or was it like a flash? It just went, really quick.
I think, it did go quickly, but I think what recalls it is that, people do, people ask about your debut and what it made you feel like. So I do recount it a lot of times. So it does help that, I think. Just when someone asks a question, you kind of have to go back and try and sort of think what you're feeling, what's it like. But the actual game itself is a bit of a blur. It's a bit of a blur, which is a worry. But there we are,
I don't think, come much to in that game, so everyone could probably understand that it went 90 minutes, must have seen like nine.
Exactly. One of the things that I found out in doing the research for the book, and that's, just reading back and looking at stuff, was, you mentioned about games not being televised as much. And I found out that season I made my debut and I played for the Gate Spurs. There was a TV strike and football was off the screens for, I think it was like 6 or 8 months. I only found that out reading, looking. And so my debut wasn't even screened because of this. Like, I think, oh man, not only that, back in the day they didn't film games in a general rule, but it was the ones that they did film, it was a strike on that in that year. So I don't think
I remember seen, the strike, but I don't remember it going on that long.
I think that was just. That's just like Europol. I mean, quite often both ITV and BBC technicians were on strike about various different disputes with the company. And then TV was just, even the 80s, I think in the 85-86 season, the first 6 months weren't transmitted anywhere. So yeah, there's something, as we said before, there's so much of your career. I mean, wouldn't you love to watch your debut again on YouTube and just relive the moment and talk us through what happened, but you've been denied that opportunity?
Yeah. I often think about that. It's so the coverage that's going on now for these guys, it's just a different world. But it's still enjoyable. Still, I've lived the dream. Most people want to be footballers and play for your club that you've grown up supporting. You just got to enjoy that. If you don't, I've tried to enjoy that, particularly now that I've finished playing. I want to share my experiences for others that wanted to hear about it. There was a lot of people that were asking me questions, and it's been a good process. Actually, I've enjoyed doing it. I've enjoyed doing it at this point as well, because I think, when I've reached a certain age where I can kind of, I'm clear about what I've experienced, and I think I can talk about it, hopefully in a way that people can get an understanding of it.
Oh, definitely, Paul. I mean, I was fascinated by you described in some detail the difficulties of a younger footballer trying to break it through, trying to make an impression with the senior pros. I was fascinated by your story about Alan Sunderland, that he was consistently nominating you as the worst player of the game in your 20-minute practice session. Now, as a young pro, what does that do to your confidence? Because you must have shown such resilience to actually deal with that.
That was a particular incident that is one of many that would happen, and you have to show resilience in those situations. And whether it's hard to know whether someone's doing it for just the crack of it, to have a joke, and it's fun for them, or is it that it's for another motive? And it's hard to really gauge, you can never know what's going on in somebody's mind. But at the time, for me, it was awful. it was a test, a test I was able to get through. And I talk about that because I'm not sure whether Alan in that particular instance knew the effect it was having on me. Well, I didn't actually know it was him, so I didn't know who he was, but it might have been just a little joke to him, but it was having a massive effect on me. But I managed to get through it. And people that read book will understand what we're talking about. But I think it's an example of just how by doing something, you might not even be aware that the effect that you're having on somebody. And it could be a major effect as well. So the consciousness of our behaviours is big.
It's a very good point,
Paul. Sorry, Paul, go on.
Yeah, just to finish off that, I mean, it's a very good point, Paul, because you know, something that somebody thinks is a bit of banter and a bit of fun, they don't understand the hurt and upset it can cause the person on the end of that treatment. And, you know, for a young player like you, that must have been so demoralising that, you know, a player you respected, you know, when you found out later he was the one nominating you week after week. I mean, it's just appalling, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I think this sort of stuff goes on generally in life, and people don't realize the effects of their action, their words. And that was definitely a case. You know, I remember it vividly, you know, getting these votes, and I'm thinking, you know, this is not, who's doing this to me? It's like, and it was, but I've managed, you know, somehow just kind of that determination to succeed and do well for myself overrode any of the other stuff that was going on. But I've seen other players fold and, you know, go out of the game. I've seen many. It was part of the sort of, and there was lots of tests. Yeah, I look at it now and I think people put you in situations where they were testing you and seeing how far you could go with it. And I suppose maybe that was one of the tests.
You've had a sensational Arsenal career without a doubt. I mean, you know, I remember standing there clapping like it was going out of fashion. It's interesting. The book deals with a lot of the emotions, as you've said. The lowest point must have been the injuries, because you missed out on the 89, didn't you, because of an injury. What's that type of isolation like? How difficult are those times for you?
Yeah, that particular season, the 89 season for me, is so mixed with emotions. Yeah, the injuries. I mean, the 89 Liverpool game, I would have played in that team. I would have played. And I look back now, I see all the clips, and we won it. We won the game, and I'm happy. But you're not on the pitch. It's a different story. So even now, all these years later, and it comes up on, you know, it comes up when the anniversary and people start showing it, and there's that twinge, you know, there's always like, I would have been playing if I hadn't been injured. I can't get out of my head. It's tough injuries, but injuries are part of the game. They happen, and you know, other players have missed games. But yeah, I had a fair set of injuries, and you know, as a player, as a sports person, you got to learn to deal with it. My. You know, I talk about the book about I had fallouts with George Graham, and he left me out for 18 months. And I talk about that because that again, and I was, and I talk about how the game really has changed in terms of the power of managers against players. So back then, the manager had the power over the players. Now it's kind of almost, it's like players have got the power. So I bring that up because it was, at the time, and I talk about it in the book, the fans are being told that I had injuries, but I didn't have injuries. You know, and looking back, I think, well, you know, the propaganda sometimes that were coming out towards the fans wasn't always true, but it was convenient.
Getting back to that injury, Paul, did it damage your confidence? Because in the book you say about, you know, your ability to pass the long ball. Did it have that major effect on your game?
Yeah. injuries are so underrated almost. It's like if you had a bad operation, knee operation or whatever operation, and you've had it, always watch the players now. So for example, I look at Van Dijk as an example. He's had a knee injury about two seasons ago, I think, and he's come back. And for me, he personally, looking at him, he's not the same player as he was. But you know, others, if you haven't had injuries, you probably don't see it, don't notice it. And when players have major injuries like that, a lot of the time they come back and they're trying to just manage that injury, and the game has changed. So me personally, I had to manage and try and change my game. I wasn't able to. I talk about it in the book. You know, kick balls a certain distance. I wasn't confident to do things I was able to do before. So psychologically, again, I tried to explain about how you kind of get through this, because nobody else knows this is going on. By the way, you know, the fans don't know. They see you out there. They think you're fit to play. You're out there. You're fit to play. But they don't know this stuff that's going on. So, yeah, we wanted to kind of talk around that as well and try to educate the fans on that side of it, what goes on being a professional when they step out onto the pitch. You know, things are not always as smooth as they may think it is. You know, personal things that are going on in people's lives. You know, we're still human beings and stuff that goes on. So it was all that we wanted to share with people. And hopefully that comes across. And injuries played a definitely big part for me.
Myself and Paul were very intrigued by the George Graham bit, which we're going to go into, if that's all right. You must resent the way he treated you. You say it blew your relationship apart. How difficult was the whole period?
Yeah, really. I talk about it again in the book. I wanted to just share that with the fans, how it came about, how it came to be that we fell out, why it happened, you know, the results of that, how it could have been different. I wanted the fans to just hear my version of that. And yeah, hopefully, you know, I feel as though I've told it in an honest and fair way from my point of view. And yeah, the fans can read it and sort of they can piece, you know, their recollections of that time, how they saw it, and they can piece it together and kind of make their own sort of mind up on what they feel about it. But yeah, tough times, you know, when you're sort of at the prime of your career, 28, and just being sidelined for no footballing reasons is a real tough one for me. And I don't know how I got through that 18 months. Some of the stuff that was going on just was crazy. I just wanted to kind of share that with our fans.
Well, I mean, looking back at the positive signs with George Graham, what's it like when you suddenly realise this manager is going to win trophies for this club and I'm going to benefit from it? What goes through your head then?
Yeah, again, I talk about how when he came in, George, he just changed it and made sure that people knew what they were doing. He brought a togetherness with us to the team. I'll talk about that, and we had some great moments, George and I, and that's all in there as well.
Do you speak to him, Paul?
Say again?
Do you speak to him?
I haven't seen him for a little while, but I've seen him we have seen each other at a few events.
We could do about 3 hours with you, Paul. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. If you get stuck for anything to do, you'll never will do. But if you want to come back, I'd love to hear from you, see what you're up to.
No, it's been, I really enjoyed talking to you guys. And thanks for having me on. And yeah, hopefully the fans will enjoy the book.
I'll do it for me. I as an Everton fan, I'm not an Arsenal fan, I thought the book was fascinating from start to finish. Paul, and your insights into your career pre-Arsenal, at Arsenal, post-Arsenal. No, it was a real page turner for me. But yes, you were one, even though you didn't play for Everton, you were one of my favourite players in the 80s and 90s. And your achievements in the game are absolutely outstanding. And it's just a pity there's no more clips of your football career on YouTube. But it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. And the depth you've gone into these answers has been absolutely fascinating. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
One interesting bit, Paul, in the background, you've got a picture of yourself in the Arsenal kit, like a before and after. You take care, Paul. You look after yourself.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers, Paul. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you.
See you later.
Bye.
My thanks to Silent Dave. You can find him on Twitter as SilentDave101. That's also the home of Jay, who you can look up as the Bald Gooner. You can cozy up with Connor at ConnorJack2 on the Twitterverse, and Paul is at PMacCap. Look up Lauren on LaurenD2710. The podcast is on every social media outlet, TikTok, Facebook, Twitter. Shout outs to Brandon Murphy, Dave Miller of Arsenal Attic, Simon DC of Let's Be Arsenal FC, which is twin to the podcast. Also check out arsedevils.com for opinion and news on all things Arsenal. Please like and follow this audio version of the podcast and subscribe to the YouTube version of the show. Want to say hi, ask a question or take part in the show? It's an Arsenal thing for at gmail.com. A big thanks to all of you who support us, whether you listen or watch. Until next time, look after yourselves and each other. And finally, remember this, North London is most certainly red.
Well, my father often told me when I was just a lad, a sailor's life is very hard, the food is always bad. But now I've joined the Navy, I'm aboard a man of war, and now I've found a sailor ain't a sailor anymore. Don't haul on the rope, don't climb up the mast. If you see a sailing ship, it might be your last. Just get your civvies ready for another on a shore. A sailor ain't a sailor ain't a sailor anymore. Killicott, our mess, he says we had it soft. It wasn't like that in his day when we were up aloft. We like our bunks and sleeping bags, but what's a hammock for? Swinging from the deckhead or lying on the floor. Don't haul on the rope, don't climb up the mast. If you see a sailing ship, it might be your last. Just get your civvies ready for another on a shore. A sailor ain't a sailor, ain't a sailor anymore. First went up and down, then with more technology the engine went around. We know our steam and diesels, but what's a main yard for? A stoker ain't a stoker with a shovel anymore. Don't haul on the rope, don't climb up the mast. If you see a sailing ship, it might be your last. Just get your civvies ready for another on a shore. A sailor ain't a sailor, ain't a sailor anymore. Gave us an Aldous map so we could do it right. They gave us a radio, we signal day and night. We know our codes and ciphers, but what's a cipher for? A button tosser doesn't toss a button anymore. Don't haul on the rope, don't climb up the mast. If you see a sailing ship, it might be your last. Just get your cities ready for another on a shore. A sailor ain't a sailor, ain't a sailor anymore. And now we've got an extra one because they stopped the tot. So we'll put on our civvy clothes, find a pub ashore. A sailor's just a sailor, just like he was before. Oh, ha!